Blog Talk Radio.
Tennessee whiskey.
when your legs don't work like they used to before. And I can't sweep you off of your feet. Will your mouth still remember the taste of my love? Will your eyes still smile from your cheek? Darling, I will be loving you till we're 70. And baby, my heart could still fall as hard at 23. And I'm thinking about gone and my memory fades, and the crowds don't remember my name. When my hands don't play the strings the same way, I know you will still love me the same. 'Cause honey, your soul could never grow.
that means, yep, you guessed it, it's a drip the mic day. The author Hezzy and God is Love going up on a Tuesday like it's a Friday. Two literary prodigies, these Scholars be so talented, they can write a novel about water and still entertain a nice tray. No filters tonight, they might say bright day-inducing diatribes that could make a life change. Man, if you ain't gang-gang and don't hang with the office lounge on Tuesday, you might want to rearrange how you prioritize things. This is family, man. The author's lounge, maintained by overstanding what's understood so the unnecessary doesn't have to be explained. The pilot and co-pilot flying this plane, entertains by unleashing verbal positive cargo as if it's carried by a train nonstop through your earlobes all the way in until it reaches the creative portion of your brain. If the mic is going to the top, high like we just copped a whole pound of the best strain, conducting top interviews and use our platform to help those who choose to network and idea exchange. This is 2 hours of insane vibes. The Archer's Lounge goes live every Tuesday at 6 p.m. Central and 7 p.m. Eastern. Guess what? We can be heard worldwide. You know, I sit back like watching Hezzy quarterback like he come with the content and the God is love catches the ball like running it up the side. Grip the Mic presents the Author's Lounge. Stick around so we can drop that sound that up until inception, you and others have been denied. Now, ladies and gentlemen, let's hear those hands collide and please help myself and the Drip the Mic Network welcome the Author's Lounge with your host, the author Hezzy, and co-host, God is Love in the building. Let's get it.
Welcome, everybody. It's a sweet Tennessee whiskey. How y'all doing tonight?
That's how we start, brother. That's how we start. That's what you're going to do to my ears right now.
I had to. Oh, man. Everybody, man, welcome to the office. Already, we didn't start.
Listen, ladies and gentlemen, this is just to let you know what y'all in for. Go ahead, my brother. Go ahead.
I want to welcome y'all to the Author's Lounge, presented to you by Drip the Mic. Call in 646-378-0355. Press 1 to speak. And yes, y'all hear that lovely music at the beginning. It says, sweet,
the music, yeah.
Tennessee whiskey. Well, man.
That's right. Listen, ladies and gentlemen, now, I want to sit in for God is Love for a while. Listen, I know I don't sound like she sounds on the radio, but she'll be here, and I'll be out your way. So, you know, I hate to disappoint y'all, but I will be sitting in for God is Love. Co-hosting for your host, Hezzy the author. So what it do, bruh?
Yes, sir. And matter of fact, our first guest was born in North Carolina. He always knew he wanted to be a writer after graduating high school. He attended college and pursued a degree in education, but later decided to change course and follow his dream to become a novelist and children's author. Now he's a full-time writer, editor, and blogger. He spends his free time dreaming up stories and reading. He is passionate about spreading Christian messages through his writing, watching science fiction and superhero movies, and collecting comic books. I am your host, Arthur Heaven, and our first guest is Mr. J. Edward Holt.
In the building.
On the line.
Hey,
building.
Hey. How are you doing?
Good. How are you doing tonight?
Welcome to the drip.
Oh, I'm doing all right. A little bit chilly, but
wow.
Doing okay.
Welcome to the author's lounge, Mr. Holden. Thank you so much for spending your evening with us. And real quick, if I could say, ladies and gentlemen, if you have questions, comments for any of our guests, any of us hosts, like, for example, you want to talk to Hezzy about his singing online on the air, feel free to pick up your phone and dial that number, 646-378-0355. Press that 1 to get in queue. Got a question?
Yes. Raise your hand, please. Mr.
Let's do it.
You got to forgive me, Mr. Holt. I'm just on another level tonight.
That's all right.
Listen, if you know anything about Hezzy, listen, it's not just tonight. I'm not going to let him get away with that. It's not just tonight.
So, Mr. Holt, you from North Carolina? I lived in North Carolina a couple times.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, that's Greensboro.
Okay, yeah, I'm about 2 hours from there.
And the ever-forsaken Raleigh.
Yeah.
And
about
Lenoir.
2 hours from there.
Lenoir,
is that? That's up in the mountains,
ooh,
isn't it?
Boy, you talking about mountains. Boy, right around
mm-hmm.
Boom. Oh, man, you talking
mm-hmm.
about cold.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. And no, I mean, they talk
the beach.
They talk country in Lenoir. I didn't know you could talk
yeah.
in countries. You could, but they talk country. I couldn't even understand that language. I was the only African-American in the town.
Oh, really?
Wow. But I loved it, though. I didn't want to leave. My daughter's mother said, you need to come home now. I was like, I don't want to.
Oh, wow.
I'm for real. I was the only African-American in the town. And you know where the bus dropped me off at? On the street. There's no Greyhound station. Mm-hmm. You get dropped off on
mm-hmm.
the street.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
They dropped me off dead in the middle of town and say, make it.
Oh, wow.
I know. I went up there last Christmas, but it was too cold for me.
Oh, man, yeah. Hey, and boom, well, Appalachian State, it's beautiful, though. It's really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we went to the Daniel Boone Inn. That was a good meal.
Oh, man, yeah. Oh, you ever get on that the railway, the old rail train down there?
If you talking about Tweesy?
Yep, Tweesy's.
Yeah, we went to Tweesy. Yeah, we went
yes.
to Tweesy last Christmas.
Okay. Yeah,
it was cold
down there.
Man. It was like 30 with a wind chill of 20.
Oh, yeah. Because when I was down there, the Morganton Little League baseball team went to the World Series. That was a big
mm-hmm.
thing. That was a big thing.
Hmm.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Edwards, I'm going to let you go ahead and tell the world a little bit about yourself. So we can talk about
right,
North Carolina
yeah.
all day.
North Kakalaki.
All right, so
yes,
yeah, I'm J. Edwards Holt. I'm an author of fantasy fiction. Most of my stuff is geared toward the teen and young adult category, but I've also got one children's book and a comic book, and I got 7 books on the market right now, and I'm finishing up number 8. And after that, I got some more in the pipeline. I'm working on my second trilogy right now, finishing up the second book of that. And that,
wow.
too, is fantasy. It's kind of like Lord of the Rings and any kind of fantasy, like Game of Thrones type stuff, you know, that kind of fantasy stuff. But all my books, they've all got, you know, Christian messages in them, like kind of hidden within them. So.
That's how I try to write, too. I always, you know, because God gave us the talent. And so we always want to put him somewhere in our book.
Absolutely.
You know, to give him praise.
Absolutely.
I always try to do that. I don't care what kind of book I'm writing. It could be erotica romance. It could be a regular book. It's always giving God his praise because he gave us the talent to do this. So with me saying, since you are a fantasy writer, man, I don't know. I couldn't even write fantasy for nothing. What made you
right,
get into
right. that? That's a hard thing to do.
Like Lord of the Rings, I can't even do that.
Right, like so. Yeah, I mean, and that's my question. Like, like, where as a fantasy author, where do you draw your ideas and your inspiration from? You know, I mean, because I would imagine it comes easy to you, but like for somebody like myself, it would come. That would be a challenge to me because it would be a problem with me to come up with, say, for example, a character or a setting or you know, something like that. How do you, where do you draw that from?
Well, you know, as a kid, you know, I read a lot of those books and I was always watching, you know, fantasy kind of movies like Harry Potter, Star Wars, any kind of that stuff pretty much I was watching. And I just always had ideas in my head. You know, I was always, just constantly, my parents said I was always telling them stories that I had come up with. And, you know, I couldn't help it. I was all the time coming up with stories. And just a few years ago, I decided, well, you know what, let me go ahead and write these things down, you know, just in case somebody might like them. And, you know, then I ended up publishing my first book. So, but, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, I'm pretty much all the time thinking of characters and stuff in the stories. So. You know, it pretty much comes to me naturally, actually.
So when you was growing up, did you ever think that you would be a fantasy writer, or what was your dreams growing up? What was you thinking of? What was your mindset?
Yeah, when I was younger, like in elementary school and stuff, I had thought about, you know, always wanted to be like a writer or a movie director or something like that. Then I kind of forgot about it a little bit when I was in college and just kind of focused on, you know, doing something that I thought would make money or whatever because I didn't know about it. And and then I just realized that I wasn't really happy in anything else I was doing. So, you know, I took the time to write the first book and I just kind of got addicted to it.
That's sweet. So what's your first book's name?
It's Little Man, Big Treasures.
Exactly. Can
you
give us a little
Oh yeah, that was published in 2017.
Okay, give us a little inside detail of what goes on in this book. Because your first book is your baby.
Yeah, for sure, definitely. It's the first of a trilogy. It was originally just going to be a standalone book, but pretty much as soon as I finished it, I started getting ideas for sequels, so I wrote some sequels to it. But it's the whole trilogy, the Little Men, Big Treasures trilogy. It's about dwarves, and I don't know if you've seen, like, Lord of the Rings and stuff. You know, the dwarves are, like, the smaller, you know, how they with the beards and stuff, the smaller people, you know, this is about some dwarves that are particularly one dwarf that has grown up as a treasure hunter. And, he finds out about this, long lost treasure that a king is looking for. And so he takes a couple of his friends and some of his family and they go off looking for it. And, you know, along the way, they meet these like fantasy creatures, you know, some things that creatures that I've made up and stuff. And they get into a lot of, adventures and there's a battle and, you know, it ends up, setting the course for the rest of the books to follow, pretty much.
Okay. Oh, sweet.
But the book itself warns against the dangers of, you know, greed and, you know, doing things out of desire to get rich and stuff like that, and teaches the importance of family too.
Oh, that's nice. I like that idea.
Yes.
And what is it that determines in your mind with you, what makes you decide on whether one of your stories should be a sequel or a trilogy or continue on? What has been the deciding factor in those?
Yeah, it depends. It depends on, you know, the response to it, and then of course, you know, if I can come up with an idea for a sequel. Those are the main two things.
Amazing.
So what was your inspiration growing up? Who was you inspired by?
I always liked to read stuff by C.S. Lewis. Wrote Narnia.
Yes. He was the best.
Yeah.
C.S. Lewis was
the
best.
I always loved those books. And there were some other authors, too. I grew up reading the Harry Potter books, and I read The Hobbit, too. And so I was inspired by all those authors, you know.
That's great. So what are your go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask him who's his favorite author now. Are those authors your favorites as of this day as well, or they just are the authors who inspired you?
Yeah, pretty much. I pretty much like C.S. Lewis. I think that's my favorite author. Yeah.
Yeah, C.S. Lewis. He's a great author. It's another one called. Is it C.L. Lewis, the one that writes the Western novels?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He also has some dope books too.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I've actually never read any westerns, but I need to. That'd be pretty cool.
Oh man, he writes.
Me neither. You're not alone. You're definitely not alone. that's something that Hezzy pulled out of his neck. I don't know what. I don't do westerns either.
Hey, I love them.
Hezzy's pretty eclectic. He's an eclectic dude. So he, you know, ain't no telling what he has his hands or what's in his book library.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, the Western Frontiers, man. I used to like to travel. You know, when you want to travel, you read them books, man. You know, you started out with Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, and then you want to branch out. You get into
the last thing I remember, Western was Cowboys versus Aliens, the movie I went to go see. They had to put aliens in it for me to go see it, so. That's about the knowledge.
It looks good.
Oh, Cowboy! Oh, that's an excellent movie. It's an excellent one. It's excellent. I love the whole premise.
I gotta check that one out then.
Get into that fantasy stuff. I was always like, I want to know about how you do this, how they did this, and how it's all history for me.
Well, aliens really ain't fantasy. Those are they're real. And so are zombies.
That's
zombies
like
are real, too.
More like science fiction or something.
I believe zombies are real. I'm sorry. That zombies are real. And vampires.
Yeah, I believe vampires are real.
I believe vampires and zombies exist. I believe they exist, but I know there's aliens out here. I mean, the arrogance of us to think that out of all God's creation, we're the only planet that he put life on.
Yeah.
Right. Not very probable.
Exactly.
So, Mr. Edwards,
you were talking about Tom Sawyer. I did have a reader. I had a reader not too long ago say that they said that Little Men, Big Treasures was a lot like Tolkien meets Tom Sawyer. So that was a compliment for me.
Yes, definitely. Big compliment right there. But I love that book. I love that one. Mm-hmm. Huckleberry Finn. Oh man, yeah. What?
Right.
When they told me I was going to get a free pizza in school, I read them.
Yeah, you know you're talking about food big time. I'm surprised you're not chewing on nothing right now.
I just did.
So, No wonder. I know it was a good reason. So James, are you? Is your goal to get one of your novels or any of your work on the big screen?
Yeah, that would definitely be a goal. I you know, that would be my dream. You know, is for that to happen, mm-hmm. for sure.
And I've always wanted to ask authors this, and you could feel free to chime in too if you have an answer for this. Now, when you're writing your books, do you have it in the back of your mind? You're writing it as if it's going to big screen.
Oh,
or do you write it for big screen specifically?
Well, I kind of play the scenes out, you know, like a movie in my head, and I always kind of write it with that mentality, you know.
Hmm. Interesting. And Hezzy, what about you?
Hmm.
Hezzy?
Oh.
I hear you.
Oh.
I definitely do. Cause I like to play my scenes out like I'm watching a movie.
Mm-hmm.
I want all the action. I want all the drama. I want everything to come. I want it to flow. Just like a movie. So when
right.
you read it, when you're reading it, you're actually watching a movie.
Right.
I want you to be right there. I want you to be right there with me as I'm going through
mm-hmm.
each scene, each character, and letting
you
know that. Yeah, definitely. So yes, it's definitely
mm-hmm.
You're writing this. You're in the movie.
So
I don't need
it. What are the challenges in painting that image, you know, like if I'm reading, you know, so, I mean, what challenges do you face? I mean, because I would imagine you would have to be a little bit more detailed in your writing for, you know, to set a specific scene for the reader.
Mm-hmm.
What are the challenges that come with that versus it actually being on the big screen? And again, that's for both of you.
All right. It's always a challenge coming up with a setting, especially if you're not familiar with it. You know, like sometimes you might have to do some research, you know, like if they're in a location that you don't know a lot about or something, to know what words to use and everything. And for me, I just try to do my best to paint it where they can see it. And I say, I can see it in my head, but I want to make sure they can. And so I try
right,
to be as,
right, exactly.
as detailed
right
as possible without like getting boring, you know. But
mm-hmm.
so that's
mm-hmm.
one thing. You have to be detailed, but not too detailed. If that makes sense.
Definitely, you don't need to know that the leaves has the veins going through it and all of that.
Yeah.
Right, right.
I hate them books like that. Or you have to get a dictionary to find out what that word means. You're like, okay,
yeah.
I can't read this book.
I tried to read a book by Iceberg Slim. I can't remember the name of the book. And I know exactly what y'all are talking about when y'all say that, because it was so – he put so much into describing every detail of every scene that I literally – got bored and just closed the book. I wanted the book so bad. But, I mean, he described everything. Some things, yes, I'm sure you want to describe, you want to show a setting, but, you know, it was just some of the verbiage he was using. Like, for example, he was talking about somebody smoking a cigarette. He was talking about a person, but they were, at the time that he was talking about that person, they were sitting somewhere smoking a cigarette. And he used all these over-descriptive words.
Yes, exactly.
As the smoke left the cigarette, it did a 1-2 step around the, you know, it was just too much. And it
yeah.
got to being so much that it lost me. It lost me. And I was
right.
like, I know this is Iceberg Slim. I know he's a legend. But this is too much. I can't get through. I can't even get through this first chapter, you know. And so
right,
I do know
yeah.
for a fact, as a reader and who has been in a situation like that, it takes just a few words or just a little bit of an over description to lose the reader from the whole exact book. Because I'm like, if this first chapter starts off like this, I don't want to be doing this whole book. I need to get to the action.
Right. Right. Yeah. You don't want to slow the plot down too much. Because they might forget about it, for one thing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know. So I mean, I mean, we like to be as readers. We love to be brought in. We love to know what you're thinking. We love to be able to read your words and see what you wanted us to see, and be able to go on that journey with you. But if it's just too much, if it's over descriptive, if I'm sitting here talking, if I'm talking to somebody and I'm telling them a story, like, you know, man, I walked in a girl's house and she had the cigarette lit and the cigarette was sashaying around it, you know, like one of my boys is going to be like, man, just get to the story and tell me what happened. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
You know, so.
Yeah, her panties was hanging out the chandelier and I was sitting
right. And chandelier is still fat at medium speed.
Hey.
The third fan had dust on it, you know, like all that.
So
pennies were purchased. These weren't your Victoria's Secret pennies. These pennies were purchased at Target.
Kmart.
There was a sale going on, and
you can read the tag.
Book ain't got nothing to do with the pennies. And you're never gonna meet these pennies again. These pennies are never going to be met again in the store.
Right.
You're never going to run into these pennies again. That cigarette that he smoked is gone after that. There's no more tobacco left. So I don't need to know that much about the cigarette, because that cigarette, I won't run into that cigarette later on in the store. You know what I mean? So.
Yeah.
Right. So, Mr. Edwards, you got any books? Well, I would like to hear an excerpt from one of your books.
Yes.
Yeah, let me see. Paul, let me go find one right quick. Let me see one here.
I just had myself an evening cup of coffee, bro. So, I'm ready. I'm ready for the show.
All right. Me too. I ain't had no cup of coffee.
Why
though.
Does that not surprise me? Why does that not surprise me? And we want a good excerpt too. We want some tea. We want some juice. We want some action.
Some dragons and fire.
Getting beamed up. Something like that. Ladies and gentlemen, remember, if you are listening online and you have a question, you heard something interesting that you want to ask our guest or our next guest or either one of us, again, pick up that phone and dial 646-378-0355 and press 1 to get in queue to ask the question. You are listening to the Author's Lounge on Drip the Mic Network, hosted by the author, Heavy, in the building.
All right, let's see here. Looking for an excerpt here. So you want to hear some action, huh?
Yes, sir.
All right, so I'm going to read from the first book, Little Men, Big Treasures. This is at the end when they're having the final battle. Let's see, the main dwarf, his name is Obalin, and his brother is Clan, and then there's some other creatures fighting with them too, but I'll go ahead. So, meanwhile, inside the mountain, Obalin, Clan, and the Lefenor were fighting a battle of their own. Valley trolls came left and right as the group of three fought them off as best they could. Elefenor's fighting abilities were amazing. He moved incredibly fast, and slew troll after troll with ease. Even Clan was fighting well. Using an axe that Obalin had given him years earlier, he cut down troll after troll. This was, of course, thanks to everything Obalin had taught him about fighting. Obalin was holding his own in the battle, too, as he was efficient with an axe, but also an expert throwing knives, of which he had many. With every troll they slew, it seemed 10 more took its place. When things were beginning to get overwhelming, Elefenor shouted to Obalin, "The bright gem, now!" But Obalin nodded and reached into his bag, pulling out the bright gem. Ryan and Elefin will close their eyes, and with a squeeze of O'Ballin's hand, the bright gem lit up the room. The light was too much for the valley trolls, as they had been in the caves for so long and had adjusted to the darkness. The light was so strong that it immediately burned their eyes out. The trolls were now blind and screaming in agony, which gave the dwarves and the Lefnor a vast advantage. The group of three began forcing the remaining trolls back toward a cliff not far from them. And then it cuts here to the head of the trolls, which is his name is Traxel. Having secretly been watching the battle from afar, Traxel decided it was time to end things. The bright gem had to be destroyed and its wielder along with it. Still unseen for the most part, Traxel pulled out an enormous crossbow, nearly the size of his arm. He placed a large arrow on it, aimed at O'Ballin's chest, and fired. By the time O'Ballin saw the arrow coming for him, it was too late to move. Knowing that death was coming, he closed his eyes. He cringed as he heard the arrow pierce his heart. But wait, he looked down and see that no arrow would touch him. But when he looked up, he saw something that would scar him for life. At the last possible second, his brother Clan had stepped in front of him and taken an arrow through the heart for him. It took a moment for O'Ballin to process what had just happened, but when he did, he screamed at the top of his lungs. Lefnor roared as loud as he possibly could, causing all the remaining trolls to run away in terror. Standing on the edge of the cliff, an arrow inside him, now Clan looked at his brother one last time and smiled. "I told you this was a bad idea," he said before slowly falling back over the cliff and into the dark abyss of the mountain. O'Ballin paused for what seemed like an eternity. Traxel laughed and roared in victory, but when Elefnor made eye contact with him, he cowered away and fled deeper into the mountain. He wasn't about to pick a fight with another guardian. Elefnor rushed over to comfort O'Ballin, who was now on his knees and deathly silent. Elefnor embraced the dwarf and held him close. He knew there was nothing he could possibly say that would comfort O'Ballin in this moment. After a few moments, O'Ballin looked up at Elefnor. The dwarf's eyes were filled with tears and hatred. In O'Ballin's eyes, Elefnor saw a deep anger, a darkness like he had never seen before. Hoping to change the mood, Elefnor gave a gentle smile, a smile that said everything was going to be okay. "There is a war going on outside," he told O'Ballin. "They need our help." "I'm going to kill him," O'Ballin said softly. Elefnor sighed. He knew O'Ballin was angry, but at the same time, he knew that one dwarf alone would be no match for the great Traxel, the mountain troll. "Come with me, and we will help our friends in battle," Elefnor urged. O'Ballin shook his head and yelled that Traxel must pay for what he had done. Trying to calm him down, Elefnor spoke quietly. "All will receive due judgment, even Traxel," he said. "It is not our place to take revenge, but rather to leave it to the Almighty. Traxel will get his punishment in time." O'Ballin thought for a few moments. He started to consider what Elefnor had said. Then he saw Clan in his head. He saw him falling into the abyss. He saw his mother and father crying. He saw everybody back home mourning for his brother. It was too much for him to bear. O'Ballin looked at Elefnor and shook his head. "No," he said, "his judgment comes today." Elefnor sighed. It seemed O'Ballin was determined to go after Traxel, and there was no way to convince him otherwise. He feared for O'Ballin and what the mountain troll might do to him. But even more so, he feared the darkness, and he feared the darkness he saw in the young dwarf. He knew that only O'Ballin could choose his destiny. Finally, he decided to give him his blessing. After all, from what he had learned about O'Ballin, he seemed clever. Maybe, just maybe, he could defeat Traxel. Lefnor looked at O'Ballin's bag. "Blow the horn," he said. O'Ballin pulled out the horn of Thordnan and blew it as hard as he could. It didn't make a sound. He looked at Lefnor, puzzled. "Those who need to hear it will," Lefnor assured him. "Now go and don't get killed," Lefnor exclaimed, patting O'Ballin on the shoulder, then running out of the mountain to join the battle outside. Okay. All right. So that was the chapter that starts the final battle.
Yo. Wow. Okay, I got it. Okay, all right. So we need to make sure that we get this information on the page as well, because
yes.
I'm pretty sure any listeners like myself, like I was following that all along, and now I'm into the story, and so I got to find out what goes on. I got to hear. I'm interested to see how all this started. So I know if I'm feeling that way, there's listeners are that way as well. So we definitely got to get his information up and make sure that he gets it out before we're done with this interview as well.
All right, sure.
Definitely. So go ahead and give out your social media site and where we can find your book and everything.
All right, yeah. So you can, they can always go to my website, which is jedwardsholt.com, and you just click on books and it'll take you to my Amazon page. And I've also got I got Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, all those. Most of them you can just find me at
Snapchat.
And then I got a TikTok too. I got an ongoing series TikTok. It's just little explainer videos for characters and settings. So that's going on right now.
Wow, that's really unique.
Sweet. That's what's up. So what you got planned? What you got coming up next?
Right now I'm working on the second book in my second trilogy.
Okay.
Now I heard as he asked which one is your baby. Is that also your favorite? Is your baby and your favorite the same?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, because it just always holds a special place, you know.
Definitely. First one is always the best one.
Yeah, for sure.
So we all, you know, a lot of us, we have before we ever do anything, like as a poet, before I ever really. Start doing stuff. I've been writing poetry as long as I can remember. However, before I started, really showing it to people or getting published or performing at shows or performing on air or whatever, I always ask myself if I could. Can you name what was going on in your life when you, or name the time, what happened that finally made you say to yourself, yes, I could do this, or I was meant for this? What was that like?
Yeah, it was, I always did a lot of writing when I was little, so I always had people telling me, like, you know, oh, I thought you were going to grow up and be a writer and stuff like that, and, you know, I had, like I said, in college and stuff, I just forgot about it, because you know, like any college person, I had other things on my mind at that time. But, I was a few years later, I picked it back up and I kind of just decided, you know, I don't even know if I can do this, but I'm just going to try it out. You know, I'm just going to go ahead and start trying to form a story and, you know, write something down and see what I can get, you know. And, It kind of just came back to me as I started doing it, and I just was like, oh, yeah, I remember how much I enjoyed this, you know, and, you know.
Wow.
So I just kept going, so.
Interesting.
Awesome. Well, Mr. Holt, I want to thank you for coming on the show tonight, my man.
Yeah,
yes,
thank you for having me.
Yeah, I would definitely be showing your work on my platform. I'm going to have to read one of your books. I don't do fantasies too often, but I'm going to have to read yours because I can connect it with yours.
I liked what I was hearing. I'm curious as to what was going on, what happened now. So I definitely will be indulging myself.
Good,
I'm more
good,
of a true crime
good.
Guy, but yeah. But, I liked what I heard.
He also, Arthur Hezzy, I enjoyed your reading the other night too. I thought it was cool the way you used the beast metaphor, because, you know, I'm all the time writing about dragons and stuff, so that really stood out for me, but I thought that was pretty cool.
Thank you, thank you. I appreciate it, man. Yeah. Yeah, that was a little fantasy. You know, yeah. But it wasn't a fantasy, it was a nightmare, but
right.
Yeah, but it worked out, man. I really enjoyed it. That's why I was like, man, I'm going to bring him on the show, man. Let him, you know, it's good to support all the authors, because we need all the support we can.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's definitely what we're here for.
Definitely.
Yeah, I'm going to get your book, too, because I'm looking forward to reading it as well.
Oh, thank you. It's on Amazon.
Man,
it's on Amazon. Oh, North Carolina. Oh, I'll be in North Carolina soon, too.
North Kakalaki.
Yes, I'll be traveling there soon. Yes, indeed. Well, you have a good night, my man, and thank you for coming to the office lounge. We're
all
take
right.
A little
thank you all for having me.
No problem. Anytime. We're going to take
all
a little break.
I am told, ladies and gentlemen.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to have the ever-fabulous Melanie Johnson.
Melanie Johnson in the building?
Oh, she'll be here.
Oh, no, she's here. She's here. Oh, she's definitely here. Okay. And I was just saying. No, she's definitely here. I definitely hear. This is the one that you was excited about.
Yeah. She has a great story. Great story. So,
wow.
Definitely excited. So what are we going to listen to now?
Let's listen to some Neo.
Okay. I only want you
ladies
to love.
Sorry. Ladies and gentlemen, we want to thank you for tuning in to the Drift of My Network to listen to the Author's Lounge right here. We're going to take a small commercial break, listen to some music, and we're going to come back, and we're going to have the author, Melanie Johnson, in the building. We'll be right back. This is Drift of My, y'all.
Better math, your boy a good look, but she my better half. I'm already bossing, already flossing, but why had a cake if it ain't got the sweet frosting?
Yeah.
You're keeping me on my A game, without having to say names. They may flame, but shorty we burn it up. The sag in my swag, pep in my steps. Daddy do the Gucci, mommy in the steps. Yes, it's a G thing, whenever we swing. I'ma need Coretta Scott if I'm gonna be king.
I'm a movement by myself, but I'm a force when we're together. Mommy, I'm good all by myself, but baby, you make me better.
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 First things first, I does what I do, but everything I am, she's my improvement. She give me reason to not stop. And though I'm hot, together we burn it up.
The taped up cut, the cleaned up ice. The shorty come around, I clean up nice. Dynamic duo, Batman Robin. Whoever don't like it, it's that man's problem. And when I feel like I'm tired, mommy be taking me higher. I'm on fire, but shorty, we burn it up.
I'm a movement by myself, but I'm a force when we're together. Mommy, I'm good.
Like a soldier, holding
him down. She treats me like a dog, watches for the hit. Checks where I go, even watches who I'm with. The right when I'm wrong, so I never slip. Show me how to move, that's why I never trip. And baby girl, you so major, they should front page ya. God bless the parents who made ya. Middle finger anybody who hates the way we burn it up.
I'm a movement by myself, but I'm a force when we're together. Mommy, I'm good all by myself, but baby, you make me better.
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 Yeah, baby, them lames you playing with, they gon' put you down.
Welcome back to the Author's Lounge, and I'm your host, Arthur Hesse. Call in 646-378-0355. Press 1 to speak. And coming up, our next guest. She hails from, hold on, let me get it right. I don't want to get it wrong.
Please get it right.
Well, she doesn't say where she hails from, so I'm just saying like this. She's
well, let's find out.
Right. Ms. Johnson, are you on the line?
I am. Good evening.
Where are you calling
good
from?
Good evening.
I am calling from Laurel, Mississippi. I'm a Southern girl.
Lord.
Oh, you know my crooked letter. Crooked letter.
Yeah.
Crooked letter.
We like to call it the sip. The sip.
No, the sip. Oh, I like that.
Yeah, that's what we call it, the sip.
The sip, okay.
Melanie Johnson from the sip on the drip.
Yeah.
I like it.
Let me
well,
introduce.
Welcome to the Author's Lounge. Yes, please give her a proper
introduction.
Thank you. Let me introduce her. Let me pull out the red carpet for her. She is the author
yes,
of two
yes,
publications.
Yes.
She is the author of two publications and contributing author of a devotional. She's also a domestic abuse survivor and a suicide attempt survivor, and an end domestic violence advocate. She would love if you would consider her possible. Okay. She has wrote two books, Womanly Wisdom, What They Couldn't Tell Me, Broken Mirrors, Still Reflect, and she's also a contributing author in Bringing Healing to the City in Heels, Stumping Out Domestic Violence. And all three are available on Amazon. Ooh, we're going to have a good show tonight. So, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I describe myself as an educational influencer. I'm a school teacher. I teach math, the most hated subject. And eighth grade, like the most hated grade, nobody wants to.
That's
what I got. And I love it. I love it. I am a domestic abuse survivor, so I use my voice to speak for those who can't or those who are afraid to and don't know how to. I don't know. I hate talking about myself. I am an author and a poet. And I am an independent paparazzi jury consultant, so I like to.
You are in trouble. Our poetry show is Thursday, but you are on this show, so we will be getting into that. So just be prepared for that. Sorry to interrupt, but that was your fault.
That was your fault, and I
don't feel bad about it.
I don't call it a fault. That's my opportunity. How about that?
Right. I'm talking about for slipping in that poetry slip out, that I'm a poet slip out. We will. We're going to investigate that a little bit later.
Okay.
That's a good word for it, Hazy. Would you say investigate?
Investigate. Definitely investigate.
Investigate.
I'm ready. I'm ready.
All right. Oh, you heard that? Stay ready. Ain't got to get ready. All right, please.
That's
continue.
Right.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. I don't know anything else to say about myself. I always try to help people, and I use my books and my publications to try to bring light to, you know, delicate situations that people don't usually talk about, and to try to encourage other people to just think positive of themselves, because I wasn't always that positive thinking person, at least not to myself. Yeah.
Okay, so see, I want to touch on this domestic violence thing, because me growing up, I went through domestic violence, and was it when you was growing up or after you was in a relationship, or how did yours start or begin?
I was in a 23-year marriage that wasn't a good one. It started out okay, but for 18 years I tried to see if it would get better, and it didn't. So I finally had to leave, but when it became a life and death situation.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
But growing up, I didn't see that. So it wasn't something that was normal for me. And my dad was a deacon in church, so I was always at church. And I grew up thinking that when you get married, it's for a lifetime.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
You have to stay married no matter what. Yeah. And so that's what I incorporated into my marriage. I got married really young. Well, I was 20. It was a month before my 21st birthday. Yeah.
Really young, like you said.
Yeah.
So experiencing what you was experiencing going through this, how did you handle yourself? How did you even last for 18 years or just want to just, you know, stick with it? Even though, you know, the church says don't do it, don't do it. You do it for the kids or you do it for something else. What was your mindset?
Well, I was in a unique situation because my husband was a pastor, and I was the first lady of three churches.
Most of them are.
Wow.
And so, so I had
most
to make sure
are.
That I portrayed the image of a first lady. And I didn't think at the time that people would believe that the pastor acted like that. So I didn't really have anybody to talk to. He had isolated me from most of my friends and my family. So it was just like his family and the people we lived around.
So out of that 18 years, the 18 years, how many of those years were spent actually knowing? And the reason I'm asking this question, first of all, is because I hear from domestic violence victims and survivors of domestic violence that for the longest they didn't really look at it as, or they, you know, they were blinded to the fact that they were being done, like, this don't have to be, I don't have to be here. You know what I mean? They spend a lot of time not even understanding that. So how many years of that 18 were you under the understanding that, you know, like, you deserve better, this is wrong, and this is not acceptable under the marriage vows in any way? So if that question makes sense.
Yes, it does. I was married for 23 years. After the first 5 years, I knew that something wasn't right, that I wasn't supposed to be in that situation. So I stayed for 18 more years. And that last year that I was there, it was full circle to me that if I continue in this situation, I'm not going to be who I am. I'm not going to be alive. I'm not going to be viable for anybody. Because I actually tried to commit suicide twice.
Because of domestic violence.
Yes, and for a long time I couldn't say that it was domestic violence because it wasn't like I had bruises or he hit me. He only put his hands on me once, and that was like the first year we were married. And I threatened him and told him if that ever happened again, he would be alone.
So it was more mental.
It was verbal, financial,
that's
mental.
And
that's the one that people don't want to say.
It's funny that you mention that because I hear that financial you know, I'm just now hearing that. See, I didn't know that financial abuse was even a thing, right? And I'm starting to hear that more and more. And so, you know, it's just amazing that a lot of people say that. And I think the financial abuse, you hear about verbal abuse, you hear about the mental abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you hear about the physical abuse. But the financial abuse part of it is something that I don't think is touched on enough. I need to be more educated on it myself. And I think society, that's something society needs to be educated on, too, that there's not just, you know, when you think of domestic violence, you know, the first thing that comes to your mind is physical or verbal. You don't think about the other types of abuses that exist within a domestic relationship. So, and financial abuse is just a good example. And it's just, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but it's just a good example of how there are so many underlying factors that we, as people who are on the outside, or, you know, who are just getting married or thinking about getting married, these are the type of abuses that the world needs to be educated on, society needs to be educated on, because it goes deeper than just, you know, the physical bruises or the mental or emotional bruises.
And you gotta think, like, how old, well, I ain't going to ask you how old you are, but in the times that I grew up.
I don't mind. I'm 48.
Okay, so I'm 43. So in the times that we grew up, it was what goes on in your house, you keep it in your house.
That's right.
And them learning from what they seen as parents and what you went through, at that time, like we say, financial abuse, at that time you maybe only had one person working in the household, or you had both, but one wasn't making as much. And they was trying to figure out, well, how can I support myself? Where do I get help from? Who's going to help me? And when you have your family members in your relationship, they're like, no, stick it out here, get better, boom, boom, boom.
It's
not about that. No man.
And what are some of the, go ahead.
No man should put their hands on a woman, period.
Right.
Or verbal abuse is just as worse as physical abuse. Words hurt more than hands sometimes.
Yes, and I actually put a quote about that in my book, you know, bruises heal, but those words don't heal. Because anytime you hear something that reminds you of it, it triggers those feelings all over again.
Definitely, definitely. And I can remember myself growing up and going through this, and was like, okay, like you said, your husband was a pastor. I'm like, why do we go to church every Sunday? Then my life is a living hell when I get home.
Yeah.
You know.
And I didn't think that people would even understand if I tried to tell somebody. I did eventually have one person that I could talk to, and they told me you would not believe what people know that you don't know behind your back.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? So I'm up here thinking, and that's part of what I put in one of my chapters in the book about covering your image. I'm up here thinking I got my image covered, like I'm portraying the perfect household, the perfect situation, and other people are seeing what I can't cover, the things that he's doing when I'm not around, and they know, you know, they knew him. And I'm thinking, I'm walking around here, you know, acting like everything is all right, but they knew, but nobody would tell me.
Meanwhile, some shit.
You know, for me, it was always about, is this normal? Is this how life's supposed to be? And it shapes you and it scars you, because you're with different family members and you're going from house to house to stay because you don't want to be around it. But at the same time, when you wrote your first book, how did your family take your book?
My family is very supportive. I had to just disengage myself from his family because they were, most of them were enablers for him. My family knew the things that I was, they knew some of the things that I was going through, and they could see the transition of the type of person I was before him and the type of person I became after him, and they knew that something was wrong, but they didn't know exactly what was going on. So when I wrote my first book, I was really afraid of my parents reading it, because it was some things in there that they didn't know about me. And when my mom read my book, she read it before my dad. She picked it up at 5 o'clock on a Monday morning, And she read straight through it, and she finished it at 9 o'clock. And she texted me. I was at work, and she said she cried. She said she was happy that I was able to share what I experienced, and that she was sad because she couldn't protect me from some of the things that was going on.
Yes.
And,
you know,
was welcoming to me, because my dad had the same experience. Both of them started reading it, and they couldn't put it down.
What's so funny for me, my mom has never read none of my books.
Really?
She won't read. She would not read my first book because it brings back memories. I had a lot of backlash for my first book. Oh, that didn't happen. Boom, 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 this and that. Oh, it happened.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't believe he would do that. Well, he's not that person now, but that's the person that he was.
So many times I hear that one of the things that gives strength and energy to domestic violence is silence, right? The refusal to talk about it, or I've heard where men have used that as their reverse psychology, like their manipulation.
Yeah.
Hey, don't ever let anyone know what goes on in this household. And the reason I made that statement is, so once you found out how supportive and, you know, like your mom and your dad was, once they found out, do you feel like you were like silent for too long? Or, I mean, is that one of the realizations, or is that something you want people to take from your story and understand about, you know, it's okay to talk about it? I think that's the first step to getting yourself out of that situation, telling somebody. And I just think that type of manipulation has been used for all types of abusers, not just, you know, in domestic situations, you know, relative situations where they may be abusing a child in their home, you know, sexually abusing them or whatever. You know, it's always be quiet, don't tell nobody. You know, you better not tell anybody, or, you know. And so I do know that, you know, any abusive situation, silence is the biggest, asset to any type of evil that a person is going through like that. So once you discover that you did have that support, was it something like you felt like you should have known it, or how did you feel once you saw how easily that, you know, that family support and support from other people came in?
Well, my support came before I actually wrote my book. I was in my domestic situation. I had to leave like abruptly, and so my parents were there to help me get out of it. I actually left home while he was in the pulpit preaching. That's the only way I could get out. And
wow.
And so my parents were wonderful support. My mom actually had a couple at the church to mentor me, and they didn't know me, but she trusted them, and I began to trust them to mentor me, to help me to see things as they were, because I had a very distorted view of what I was in life. I didn't think I was worth anything. And my mentor, he actually, you know, worked with me for 3 years. And within that three years, I had a cousin who came up missing. And within a month, they found her body was burned in a car.
Oh, wow.
So it was a homicide.
Oh, wow.
And they've never proven what happened, but it was thought that it would be a domestic situation. And so I remember the first night that I found out that she was missing, I was on the phone with her aunt, and she was like, something's not right because she hasn't called me. So the next morning, that's when we found out she was missing. And then after they found her body, I went to my aunt's house, and she and I embraced, and she said these words to me, because I had already got out of my domestic situation at that time. And she said, I think if you would have talked to her, she would have gotten out. I think that because you were in a similar situation, she would have listened to you. I wish you would have talked to her. And at that point, it hit me. My silence possibly caused this or possibly contributed to this? And if I refuse to talk, who else is it going to affect like this? So at that point in time, I promised her, I said, you know what, I'm not going to be silent anymore. And that led me into writing my book, because I can't know that I'm silent and I'm preventing someone else from possibly getting some help.
Yeah. Wow. 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 Now, was he going to say something?
Yes, that's really awesome, because, you know, when you're going through these things, like now, like me growing up, it was even hard to get into relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was scared of relationships, because I was like, if I get in a relationship, what if I'm just like him?
Mm.
What if I'm just like what I see? Mm. And I shied away from a lot of relationships, and most relationships that I got in, I looked for a mother figure. Someone to tell me what to do. Someone that I could submit to, instead of a friendship, instead of finding, like, I was always looking for that person that was hurt, that was already had been through some stuff. I always thought I could fix them. And it wasn't, and it wasn't a relationship that I needed. I needed to love myself, and it took a long time for me to learn how to love myself.
That's it. And That's it. That's the most important piece, is learning how to love yourself all over again after you've gone through that.
And I hated everything about myself. I hated the color of my skin. I hated the way I looked.
Oh, my God. You made me want to read something out of my book.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, definitely. The floor is yours. The floor is definitely yours.
Wow. I want you to listen to this. Oh, my goodness. I can't believe you just actually said that. You don't normally hear me saying that, but this is an excerpt from my book. I did not like my reflection because it reminded me of what I did not look like. My reflection looked nothing like the images I saw on TV screens and movies or magazines. My high school life had shown me I was not a pretty girl. So seeing my reflection reminded me that I was not as pretty as them. I was not cute enough. I was not attractive enough. I was just smart enough. Yep, smart enough to know that I better not focus on my looks at all. I would look in the mirror and get angry. Angry at my flaws, or what I considered flaws. Angry at my bone structure. Angry at my weight. Angry and upset about everything about me. So to avoid being angry, I steered clear of mirrors whenever possible. What flaws did I focus on? My teeth were not straight. I had kinky hair, and it wasn't long. My eyes were brown, and they were not even the same size. My eyebrows were thick and wild. My skin was too light sometimes, too dark at others. I had even been told I was shit-colored. Who wanted to be associated with that? I had a double chin, and I was fat. My hair started to gray early. My ears were too small. I had little hands and feet. I could go on and on, but I guess you see the picture now. Anytime I saw my reflection, this is what I focused on. It did not help that my male friends and relatives always seemed to have an eye for smaller frame girls with long, flowing hair and pretty eyes. Realizing that that would never be me, I gave up the idea of looking pretty and started focusing on looking presentable, which was much less of a task.
Wow. Wow.
That was great.
Wow.
Oh, man.
Wow.
That's with me. That was me.
Both of y'all are saying some of the things. Both of y'all are saying so many things that reminds me of some of the conversations that I've had with my wife. Before I say this, I definitely have her permission. I would never bring this up without her permission or whatever. But she dealt with in a previous marriage, dealt with a very bad domestic violence situation. And one of the things that I noticed that sticks out to her when she talks about it is she talks about the financial abuse. she talks about how she had to herself get on food stamps without him even knowing, just to, you know, have extra. You know, she's having to hide money because she wanted to. I mean, I can't imagine why any man would want to do any woman that way. I mean, without me even knowing that, you know, our relationship has always been, hey, you know, I want to be financially independent. If I'm gone, if I'm not here or whatever the case may be, I always want to, you know, I don't say, hey, what do you need from the store? Or, you know, like if I have money and she don't, it's not a, you know, what do you need? I'll get it for you. No, like here's whatever you need it for. You know, I don't even care. I don't even care. You know,
can I read something for y'all real quick?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is from my book, Restoring Hezekiah, Changing the Generation. It said, my life became a self-fulfilling prophecy. I was internalizing the negative words that were being railed at me. Although I didn't really want to, I was becoming like what they were saying about me. As a man thinks in his heart, so is he. I would never amount to anything. Year after year passed, and the bad words after bad words. Look at you, Blackie, with your pug nose and buckwheat face. Look, it's Zeke the Freak. Just look at those dirty shoes and dirty clothes. The words of the beast yelling at my mother, calling her a whore, slut, and bitch. Nobody resonated in my young heart. Layer upon layer of what I would become was building on my tender conscience. My negative self-image became too dominant, my personality. I was becoming an ugly, worthless, unloved nobody. That's when I started to put up walls on the inside to protect me from the pain or damaging ridicule of people. What made it even worse was that I didn't feel like my father loved me. I had a great father wound deep in my soul. Neither did I feel like my mother loved me. That added insult to injury. She kept my brother close to her and snug in her arms. But it was as if I didn't exist. I thought that the reason was that she looked at me the way she looked at the beast. I was feeling rejected and just wanted someone to love me as is.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so that's, yeah, and that's funny because, I mean, that's another thing that she touched on. And, you know, when you see someone who has beauty, or you see a handsome brother, you know, like, I mean, if you see, I mean, for him to feel that way, and he's a handsome dude. No homo or whatever. I'm not even worried about that. I'm just saying he's a handsome brother. There's no reason, there was no reason for him to feel that way. My wife is fucking beautiful, right? And I think she's the most beautiful thing I've ever laid eyes on, but she went through that. And it's hard for me, and it's just like hearing that from like the out, you know, others, you know, and like I hear those conversations from her. She's had those conversations with me. I may even be guilty of even at times saying to myself, "No, she exaggerated. She could have never thought that she was ugly." Mm-hmm. But it's funny how I'm hearing some of the same things from both of y'all that she has told me. Again, I'll go back to the financial thing. She had to do some shit that I couldn't imagine putting my wife through just to have money. You know, I mean, like, I wasn't even raised. I was raised in Islam, right? But I do know that, you know, once I say, okay, hey, you're my wife, you know, we you know what I'm saying, we go and we literally get married in the eyes of the Creator, then you're my responsibility. So I can't even imagine the cruelty, the heartlessness, the selfishness, the all of those things that it would take to hold somebody financially hostage to the point where it's becoming an abuse. And so it's like she's educated me on so many things that I didn't know that goes on. And then just having this conversation here kind of puts it in the forefront, and it kind of adds credence to what she's been telling me all these years. And so it's funny to hear that even with you two are, if you listen to the passage that Hezzy just read and the one that you read, y'all saying the same thing.
And to touch on that financial abuse situation,
definitely.
I wanted to give you like an example of what I was talking about and how crazy it sounds. I was the director of finance for a school district. So I was over the school finances, and within our marriage, like several times throughout the marriage, he would not be working. He'd either quit his job or be let go of. And it got to the point where he would just be at home. And he said, well, I'm going to go to school this semester or something. So the only income he would get was from the church, which wasn't, you know, enough to sustain everything that he was doing.
Right.
So he would wait until I got paid. In Mississippi, teachers and school district personnel get paid once a month. So he would wait till my check hit the bank, and he would go out and do whatever he wanted to do, not paying bills, but doing whatever he wanted to do. And by the time I got off work at 5 o'clock that day, over half my check would be gone.
Oh,
I would have to take the remaining amount, pay what bills I could, and sometimes I would have to live off of, and this is for food, gas, and everything, $150, because I secretly created an account, you know, for myself, and I would just deposit at least $150 over there because he wouldn't see it. And when he found out about it, he blew up. But I had to tell him I was putting it there to pay my truck note. But I would live off of that $150 for a whole month. That's buying.
Now, let me ask you this about that.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this about that. Do you find, like, do you find yourself, I don't know if you know you're single now or, you know, if you're relationship married, whatever the case may be, but did you find that that's something that you carry to your to other relationships, just that you had to build that up, right? You know, that's not something that you had naturally, right? So you had to, you know, so you had to become that person to make sure that you are savvy enough to put those funds up and have them for when you need them. Is that a habit that you continue to take with you, or?
Yes. When I was in my relationship, when I was married, there would never be a month that my account was not overdrawn because of his actions.
Wow.
Since I've been away from him, I have not had an overdrawn account. And
wow.
I can pretty much tell you to the T, you know, where my money is going, and I don't have to worry about, okay, I got some money missing from some place. God has protected me from that, and I don't have that issue anymore.
So
I was already always savvy about money. It was just that I didn't have control over it because he would not allow me to have my own account. In our marriage, we had to have a joint account.
So the reason I ask that, because I want to tell you on behalf of, like, men, like real men, I'm not trying to, like, toot my own horn or nothing like that, but I'm just saying that's something that that's, like, a habit that's built in to my wife's DNA, even to this day. Here's the thing on my end, though. I've never let her know that I felt that that's wrong of her to do. Matter of fact, I encourage it. I'm glad that she does it, right? Because if you if that's something that you just automatically start doing in a relationship, it's okay. It's okay. Don't, like, like my wife does that now, but she doesn't do it in a way to whereas she's hiding it from me. Sometimes she's saving me, right? You know what I mean? Like, sometimes she may be like, hey, baby, let's go do this weekend. I'll be like, well, you know, we got to do this, and that. She'll be like, oh, no, I have this put up. And, I mean, so she's changed the reasoning or the dynamic behind it. But it's something that she built up. And that's okay, because I want her to know financial independence. I want her to have financial independence. I don't care if we part ways or I die. If we end up separating, I want her financially okay. And, you know, even if we've had beefs, arguments or whatever, and, you know, in a marriage, you know, we went there or whatever.
Yep.
And I've always still wanted to make sure that she's okay, if we do have to part ways or whatever, you know what I'm saying, I want to make sure that you have this, and that. You know, I mean, a part of that is because we were friends for so long. We had a 10-year friendship before we even had a relationship, before we even shared a kiss, you know. But but at the same time, though, as her husband, like, my job is not to come in and drain you for all your assets, your mental assets, your emotional assets, your financial assets. You know, I didn't. That's not why I'm here. I'm here to make your life better, whether I will continue to be in it or not. So I just want you and any woman who's ever felt that way, that taking some type of, some people may look at it as baggage, but taking whatever you want to describe that as, if you take that into another relationship, you're okay. Mm-hmm. That's fine. That's cool. Mm-hmm. That's cool. I don't mind it at all. My wife, she has it. I don't even care if she started, when she started doing it, why she started doing it. That's not my business. I think we as men are overbearing at times on infringing on a woman's privacy. You know, it's not about who she's talking to or what she has, but I don't check my wife's phone ever unless she asks me to, baby, see what the message say, answer that's such and such. Mm-hmm. And not that I feel that she's hiding something, whatever the case may be. It's just that I never go in her purse. I don't care if she's right there. She told me to go in her purse so many times. I'm like, here, go find it. First of all, I don't like getting lost in a woman's purse because half the time you're not going to find your way out of it. But for the most part, my mom just raised us to understand that a woman, whether you're her husband or not, has to be allotted a certain type of privacy. Not that she needs to do anything behind your back, but it's just a woman, you got to respect a woman's space. And I make sure that those are two of the things that I let her know coming from where she came from. Your space is always, your space is always respected. So I'll never go on your phone, never go on your purse. And as far as the financials is, my whole job is to make sure that you're not only mentally, emotionally, and physically in a better situation by the time we part ways, but also you're financially stable as well. And, now you know, so if you do take that with you, it's okay. Mm-hmm. That's all I have to say.
And if I'm in a relationship like that where we have joint accounts or anything like that, I do respect him for having a separate account and me having one, because he may have things that he wants to put money away for and may not want to have to dig into like the fund that we pay bills or whatever out of. So that's fine with me, and I don't have a problem with you having your stash and me having my stash, because I'm not doing it out of no ill will. It's just that if something comes up, like you said, if something comes up, you have a stash there, a cushion that you can work with.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right. And we do each other like that. You know what I mean? We do each other like that, because sometimes, you know, like, you know, it works both ways. And that's just the staple of our marriage, you know. And so I think that she felt a little guilt, because she always found herself explaining to me, hey, I have this, but this is why I have this. Now, this was early on. Now we're good, you know what I'm saying? And that's one thing I think as well that stops with any type of abuse, is because you have to understand each other and accept each other for who you are, not marry somebody to turn them into who you want them to be. You know what I mean? You have
and
to
I have
accept
great,
people who you are.
I have
and
a great,
you know what,
I have a great understanding. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, sir.
I have another question for you, and I have
this is a heavy show. My bad.
I have a hard time accepting a compliment.
Oh.
I also have a hard time accepting a congratulations or something good.
Oh. Wait a minute.
Mhm.
Oh my God! I can't believe you just said that.
I know what's on your mind.
I feel the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Just today, that came up just today. Last year, I was at a different school district, and last year, I was awarded. First of all, I was awarded Teacher of the Year for my school. Thank you. I wasn't ready for that. And then, you know, I rushed because they gave me the paperwork. It was lost in the mail. I had like a day to turn in paperwork for Teacher of the Year for the district. So I rushed, turned it in for the interview. I was on Zoom teaching my kids, walking into the interview for the Teacher of the Year position. And because I was just dismissing it, because that's not me. I don't want all of that fanfare. And so I walked in and did my interview, didn't think anything of it. And then right before we get out of school for Christmas last year, I was awarded Teacher of the Year for the district. I cried, and a lot of people were like, oh, I know, you're so happy. I cried because I couldn't accept that. I didn't think that I was worthy of it. And I actually wrote a poem about it, but I didn't think that I was worthy of it. And so today I'm at a totally different school district. I've been there 3 months. And today I was awarded Teacher of the Month. And this is the first Teacher of the Month for the year. And I was awarded Teacher of the Month at this new school. And it was hard to accept, very hard to accept.
Awesome.
I walked in the principal's office and I was like, I don't think that many teachers know me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I can attest to that. It is hard to accept compliments, to accept congratulatory messages. It's hard, but I'm working through it.
Yeah, I'm trying. It gets easier as mm-hmm. we get older.
mm-hmm.
But you know, it's still in the back of your head. I'm not good enough. Is this for why am I getting this? And, you know, and it all boils down for what we went through and how we had to struggle to even accept our own self. You know, like everybody gets more hyper than me when they're like, oh my God, you should be so excited. I'm also scared at the same time.
Yes. Yes. My mentor likes to tell me I'm afraid of success.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I was just getting ready to say, mine's is for a different reason. Mine's is due to my background, you know, my history and, you know, in the streets, you know.
Mm-hmm.
However, like I felt that way. Like when I went to college, I didn't even want to accept the fact that I got into college. I thought something was going to go wrong. It's like everything that I was doing that was actually working out for me. I felt like, wait a minute, this is working out too
mm-hmm.
good or too easily.
Mm-hmm.
Something's going to go wrong.
Yeah.
At times I may even be guilty of even like stopping, not even trying to do something because I didn't feel I deserved it. So I didn't feel that it would work out.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I feel that same way too, that sometimes I'm just going to deserve some of the blessings that I'm blessed with. However, so I'll be cautious. I'll probably even do that to this day, but now I feel a little bit more deserving. Back in the day,
mm-hmm.
like when I first started trying to turn my life around and get some sense,
yeah.
I would suffer from that same thing.
And but you know, for me, it's kind of weird because it's like sometimes you're like, can I get a pat on the back or
mm-hmm.
not? You know, because I remember this. I graduated college. I was 34. I graduated with a computer engineering degree, 3.7 grade point average, cum laude.
Mm-hmm.
The only person I wanted my dad to come.
Mm-hmm.
But he decided to go to church mm-hmm. instead of come to graduation.
Mm-hmm.
And that hurt.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, I had one family member at my college graduation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay, so
I can imagine
it. If it's okay with you, Hezzy, can we switch gears a second?
I want to
hear her poetry.
You know, it's funny you just said that because I had a piece I was just about to ask you, could I share? I
have
actually two pieces that follow along with what we were talking about.
Okay, all right. Well, if, like I said, if it's okay with the host, I mean, the floor is definitely yours.
Is that okay, Hezzy?
Do it. Yes, let's do it.
Okay. This first piece I want to share with you, I actually went to, I'm going to give you a little background on it. I went to see the Jennifer Hudson rendition of Aretha, and I sat in that movie and I cried the entire time because it was so much parallel to what I was feeling. And as I left, I kept hearing, I was in the bathroom washing my hands, and I kept hearing in my head, I became, and I was like, Lord, what are you telling me? So that night I came home, and I actually wrote this poem based on her experiences and my experiences. So it's entitled Became Becoming. I was born into a family loving and kind, yet I grew up without a peace of mind. Always feeling somewhat out of place, the feeling of acceptance I'd always chased. So I became the little girl feared and scared. I became the little girl who wondered if anyone cared. I became the little girl who strove to be the best. I became the little girl unable to surpass the rest in my mind. I lived my life to be pleasing to others, always wanting to help my sisters and brothers, never focusing on my wants and my needs, thinking that the only way I could succeed. So I became the girl who had no one's attention. I became the girl no one hardly ever mentioned. I became the girl that always got it right. I became the girl who had no fight left in me. I followed a dream to be the best wife. I put my desires aside and lived his life. Feeling I was trying to breathe and gasping for air, what I thought was a dream was actually a nightmare. So I became the lady who learned how to be silent. I became the lady living to always be compliant. I became the lady who was like a trophy. I became the lady who desired just to be free from pain. Then he came along and opened my eyes. It wasn't until then that I began to realize my worth was not in anyone's hand, and that was difficult to understand. But I became a woman full of knowledge and wisdom. I became a woman who no longer was a victim. I became a woman ready to step into her season. I became a woman who no longer needed a reason, because I am delivered, I am free, I am whole, I am becoming me.
That was awesome.
I just want to ask her to repeat one particular part of that I felt was pretty provocative. And that's the part where you said something to the effect, I'm paraphrasing, but you said something to the effect of you basically put your life on hold to make him look good, to make him, for him to pursue his dream, you know. Can you repeat that part for me?
I can. I followed a dream to be the best wife. I put my desires aside and lived his life. Feeling I was trying to breathe and gasping for air, what I thought was a dream was actually a nightmare. So I became the lady who learned how to be silent. I became the lady living to always be compliant. I became the lady who was like a trophy. I became the lady who desired just to be free from pain.
I can relate to that, Ms. Johnson, because I put dreams on hold for most of my life to conform to being the best boyfriend or the best husband when it wasn't really wasn't in the relationship. I was just there. You kind of see what I'm saying?
I'm just learning things. Right, I'm learning things to be careful of, to work on as well. I'm getting a lot of education from this also. But I thought that it was that particular part right there said a whole lot. And even from women who wouldn't necessarily say they're in an abusive relationship, but, marriages are good. Even if you have a good marriage, you can always tune it up a little bit more. And so, my love, I'm a poet. My love is dancing. I mean, my wife's love is dancing or whatever. However, she spends a lot of time with me doing poetry, work in my poetry community or whatever the case may be. And so I try to be careful not to make sure that I'm not allowing her to do that, or I'm not making her feel that she has to accommodate my life. You know what I'm saying? Now, I love that she's a fan of my work. I love that. I love that she supports me in that. But I have to be careful. And what that piece, that particular part of that piece
Definitely.
Just kind of made me think about is, you know, just reiterated the fact that I want to be careful in that respect to making sure that I'm not making her feel. Now, I know that, I mean, I don't say this, hey, you have to be on this show with me. You got to be important because I am. I never mm-hmm. said nothing like that. It has even crossed my mind. But I want to make sure that I'm not doing anything that that may come across as maybe manipulating in a nonverbal way or,
right.
You know what I'm saying? So mm-hmm. that's just something I want to be extra careful on. So I'm learning some
stuff. It's different from her taking interest in what you like and then she incorporating mm-hmm. that. That's different. It's the mm-hmm. fact that when
right.
you are not allowed to have a decision on your own and
yes.
the man has to make all the decisions, that's where that kind of situation comes in.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And that's what I had to face.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, thanks. So yeah, that was some good information. Thank you so much for that. That really
helped.
My bad, Hazzy. Didn't mean to cut
yeah.
you off and interrupt you. Man, spit that shit.
Because me and Ms. Johnson, oh my God, when you've been through this, you have a lot. It brings up a lot of emotions and a lot of things
mm-hmm.
that you just want to be buried. And I remember my grandma, because I always stayed with my grandmother when my mom and dad would fight. I was like, I'm going to grandma's
mm-hmm.
house. I'm going to grandma's house. And when she passed, I went to the hospital. They wouldn't let me see her. Now,
mm-hmm.
I was the favorite grandson.
Mm-hmm.
I was the rebellious one, but I was her favorite grandson. So...
Mm-hmm.
For my clothes, what I did, I wrote her a poem, and it's called Ode
mm-hmm.
to Von Morris. It was like
okay.
my grandmother was my rock and my strength, the only person who would catch me when it seemed like I was about to sink. She was the only person
mm-hmm.
in the world who was there through thick and thin, who would always bring me back in. She was always
mm-hmm.
there for me in the eyes of everyone to see that Hezekiah wasn't as bad as he was portrayed to be. She was
mm-hmm.
there through the bad times, the good times, there all the time. She was there through
mm-hmm.
the abuse and all my poor excuses. When I felt lonely and alone, she would always make me feel at home. When it felt like life had abandoned me, she opened my eyes to make me see. She made a boy who felt like he was an ugly duckling feel like a handsome prince, even without a kiss. When I felt ashamed
mm-hmm.
and disappointed, she was there at that moment. When I made mistakes, she was there to make my case. She would wipe away my tears and let me know I have many more years to be the man I was made to be. A man, not a beast, that the world would hate to see. She consoled my soul and said everything will be all right and hang in there because God will make it right.
Oh, I love that. And the thing about it is, as you read it, I could almost picture, like, you and your grandma, and I've never met, but I could, like,
mm-hmm.
picture that as you read it. That is amazing.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I can't. First of all, that was a bomb ass piece. I love that piece. But I can't be the only one on here that didn't spit a piece.
Come on, we waiting for you. You the one.
Wait a minute, hold on. Because, see, I think you're going to come with something. So before you come
you.
With something, let me do this second piece I wanted to do. Because, see, you're a master. I'm just, I really just started writing last year.
Oh, wow.
Before
wow.
that, I've never written
wow.
anything.
Oh, you got
so
a lot to do then.
Oh, yeah. I wrote like 5 poems in one day the other day because I kept
wow.
trying to get
oh,
the right
man.
One to submit. But I wanted
oh,
to share
wow.
this next poem because it is entitled Broken Mirrors Still Reflect, which is the second publication that I have. And the second publication is a reflections journal. So it's based upon the information that's in my book, Womanly Wisdom, What They Couldn't Tell Me. But this one it gives the reader a chance to, I got my poetry in here. I have like a thought or something to meditate on. And then I got my experience with that. And then I give them plenty of room to write what they think. And I left a lot of room because sometimes you need to revisit what you thought. So there is room where you can come back and revise what you say. But I wanted to read Broken
yeah.
Mirrors Still Reflect because it was a statement piece for my life. All right. Shattered images, sharp edges, fragmented pieces of disconnect. Although it seems worthless and useless, wasteful rubbish, we yet find that broken mirrors still reflect. I may not focus on the whole picture, and therefore not getting the full effect. But what I can see are images of me, reminding me that broken mirrors still reflect. Focusing on one piece over another, each detail trying to inspect, will only leave me wondering, my own self-image I'm blundering, to see just what broken mirrors will reflect. Reflection is a reactive feat, only responding to the image or subject. So what if I dislike or don't think I look like the image the broken mirror reflects? Because the reflection is broken doesn't mean I'm a wreck. Different angles it shows of a woman who grows from ashes no one would disclose and turmoil she never chose to finally expose what she supposes that everyone should know. That no matter what, you should glow, knowing that broken mirrors still reflect.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Wow. It doesn't seem like you just started.
I did.
It doesn't seem like
I really did. If I told you how I started, you would be like, nah.
Okay.
Yeah, I just started.
I want to hear it.
I have never met this guy in person, but I met this guy on Facebook who was my brother-in-law's classmate. And he would tag me, and my sister would tag me and stuff, and he would see it. And so one day, he tagged me in a post by a poet named Michael Gwynn in Texas, and he was looking for poets to submit for anthology. So I was like, oh, he did that by mistake because I don't write. So I dismissed it. And then the second time, it was right after the George Floyd incident, and Michael was putting together an anthology on Black Lives Matter. And I was like, man, I don't know why he keeps tagging me in this stuff. I'm not a writer. And I went to bed, and the night before the submissions cut off at 12:30 midnight, I woke up out of my sleep, and I wrote a poem. And I said, I'm just going to send it to him and submit it. And it was so bad because it was midnight. I was in the dark, and I was waking up out of sleep. It was so bad. It had typographical errors in it and everything. But the next morning, I got an email that said, clean this up, and I want to put it in there. And that's how I wrote my first poem.
Wow, that's crazy. That's crazy. And the reason why it's crazy is some of my best poems wake me up out of my sleep. And they write themselves.
Yes.
They write themselves. So I'm going to do this one. Do this one real quick. This one, it goes in a little bit different direction from where y'all went to. Just talking about black women, period. this piece is called Silence. This piece is called Silence of the Power Source.
Okay.
Brothers, wake up, rise up, take up arms. Let's size up on these cracksters out here on the attack of our black women. They are our new voice, and we got to catch up because our sisters are being silenced and killed at alarming rates because the world can feel them coming. My sisters are on the rise. Matter of fact, they have arrived. So everywhere to my brother warriors, this is a summons. White America moves at lightning speed to impede this melanated breed, but we as the strength of seed needs to step up, not step aside to ensure a path, as one day you could bet for damn sure a black woman will lead. It boils me to see on TV this orange motherfucker point at my sister April Ryan and say have a seat like she was beneath. I grit my teeth and think how we black men need to be like Killer Bee stepping, but protecting the queen. Our power source can't afford to have less than the strength of our best stepping up to protect. Send a message like don't fucking mess with our hornet's nest. Make no mistake, this is the silence of the power source. Our daughter, Nia Wilson, murdered at the Oakland BART station by a symptom of this evil force. So of course we need to be a force because if we as black men don't enforce, we leave our queens alone set out on a collision course. These are our issues. If your skin is black and you are a man, it ain't a question of can you. It's a statement. Sit in where the hell you can. This is the silence of our power source. Don't tell me you don't understand. Try telling that shit to Sandra Bland. Black man, stand up, man up. This tanned up so-called president has made it evident through dog whistle banter that our precious black women are to be made look ignorant because of his inability to handle their questions when they raise a hand up. makes me want to raise my hand up, shape of a black fist, and knock the shit out of the next racist ass lunatic that tries to attack my fist. We can no longer stand for this shit. They can't dismiss and silence our power source. Brothers, we need to state our case so that we shape the mindset of her to appreciate our place, replace any doubts, give her faith that you are her security. She is the base, provider of the egg, mother of the seed. A kingdom unstable is one without the queen. We diminish and demean our power source when we abuse and shame, ridicule, call B-names. If we harm our queens, others feel empowered to do the same. Today, racism has gotten brave, but we cannot let our power source be its prey. See, the stance we take must say to the other races, you're going to stay your ass out of our black queen's face. Respect is a requirement, and we require that they unhand our power source because their violence will not be the silence. You see, while we hustle for that dollar and grind for that last dime, our beautiful black dimes are under siege, and it's been time that we draw a line to these spineless crimes. America steps aside, so brothers, we need to be that protection provider. Let's lift our queens higher and make this earth brighter with the fire of our power source. Silence of the power source, unless they drip.
So what's a king without a queen? And a queen without her king? You see, we all have a role to play. It's time to take our place. For ladies, you are the egg, and gentlemen, you are the seeds. Without each other, no man is conceived. For a woman, we are given a life. But yet we allow this world to cause a strife. We disrespect her in ways that come to make her cry for days. Remember that women, that woman that you called a bitch, punched, choked, and left? Yeah, that one could have been your mother, your sister, your daughter. Don't forget your future wife. Let's take back our crowns, the ones who held us down, the giver of life, that one to your left and to your right. For she is the source whose light shines bright. Place her on display for all to be amazed, for she is queen. You see, that stance we take shows the other race. Stop stepping up in our black queen's face. Respect is a requirement, and we require, no, demand you to unhand our black women, for this kingdom suffers violence, and the violent take it by force. You see, what is a man who has a dollar and loses a dime? He searches his kingdom, looking and not leaving any gun corner untouched, and rejoices when he finds that dime. Racism to our black dime is a hell of a crime. And as a provider, you must take your kingdom a hell of a lot higher so the world can see there's nothing brighter than our beautiful black queen. Now, queen, I stated at the beginning, what's a king without his queen, and what's a queen without her king? Meaning we must do the same damn thing. Please don't get it twisted. This world we live in is wicked. Our black kings are suffering violence because of the color of their skin. Our black kings are gods by nature, strong and kind, respectable creatures, never praised for the sacrifices made from discrimination. We must take away the sting while keeping him focused on his dream. Stalked by demons but protected by queens. Remember that men, that man you call lazy, worthless, and disrespectful, yeah, that's the one you swear hurt you, could be your father, your brother, your son, and, yes, your future husband. Life and death is in the power of the tongue. But so how dare we tell him he can't, when he's already won. Success is failure turned inside out. Kings keep pressing towards the mark of the prize of the high calling. And queens, let's fix his crown, for he's the one who holds us down. Our protectors, romancers, erotic greed enhancers, our king's pain no other race can explain, nor endure the injustice that resides. Yet a spiritual, majestic power shines from his eyes. Determination and faith continues to rise. So kings and queens, we are nothing without each other. Let's stand side by side with our chest held high, uplifting one another. And that's that grip.
Awesome. Awesome.
And that is the first lady, the one I've been talking about. That's my wife.
Awesome. That is great.
Yeah,
good evening,
yeah.
Good evening.
Oh. You're amazing.
And welcome to Drip the Mic. You are now a part of the family because you have just gotten divergenized.
Thank you.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I know that it's my time is winding down, but I just wanted to, that just inspired me. I just wanted to share with you a poem that I did, and I was challenged to write it based on another poet's poem. So I'm going to read it, and
okay.
I think you guys can figure out where this poem comes from.
Okay.
If I have time, if that's okay.
Go ahead. Hezzy, you still
okay.
with us? We got quiet on it. I don't have to be eating and falling asleep.
I'm
Hezzy. Okay. Well, this one's called Melanin Marvel. Society has yet to understand how I can exist without a man. But when I divulge information, they think I can't when I can. I say, it's in the fire of my soul, the power of my words, my head held high, my voice unheard. I'm a marvel, melanated, melanin marvel. Don't hate it. When I enter the scene, I'm often ignored and neglected. When I start to speak, the naysayers and haters stand to be corrected. All of their thoughts, good or bad, are appropriately affected. I say it's the relevance of my language, the complexity of my brain, the reach of my influence that cannot be contained. I'm a marvel, melanated, melanin marvel. Don't hate it. Some are intimidated by my intellect. They try to ignore until they can't anymore, continue their level of disrespect, but instead recognize the value they see in retrospect. I say, it's in the power of my tongue, the formation of my lips, the swag displayed when my melanin drips. I'm a marvel, melanated, melanin marvel. Don't hate it. So the verdict is in. And now you should see, I don't need another to clearly define me. When you encounter my presence, grateful you should be. I say, it's in the soul of my ancestors that made me free, the teaching of my parents and the God in me, because I'm a marvel, melanated, melanin marvel. Don't hate it.
Yo. Mm-hmm. That was fucking sick. That was crazy. That was crazy what you did with Phenomenal Woman. That was genius.
Thank you.
Heavy. Can we steal her?
Yeah. That's only a little bit. That's only for a little time. No, that's right.
Okay,
yeah.
No, we want her to come to a show. We want her to come to one of our poetry shows.
Yes. Of course,
we do a poetry show on this network too. We do poetry shows
okay.
as well. Hezzy just kind of bogarted in with the author. This was a poetry network, but you know he's kind of bogarted, like elbowed his way in. And we would love to have you come out and hear some more of your poetry on one of our actual poetry shows.
Yes, I had a slide in.
Yeah, it's the same number, same time on Thursday.
Okay.
Yeah, I was saying.
That's
called the culture. Yeah, that's the culture lounge, not the author's lounge, the culture lounge. Please come by and share some more of your poetry because you are definitely a dope poet. Definitely a dope poet.
Thank you.
Sorry about your hazard.
Y'all just busy. See how they treat me over here? I'm the brat.
Yeah.
That's okay. You're still important, Hezzy.
Oh, God. He's telling the truth.
He is the brat.
Truth. Yes. Big time. Like the biggest on the network. We have how many hosts? He is the biggest brat. You think he could call you and text you and message you all types of nights and mornings? No, you don't understand. You don't even understand. If you know him, you probably know a little bit, but he knows it. That's the part that sucks, and because he knows it and he uses that shit to his advantage
on a daily basis.
Whatever works, huh, Hezzy?
Yeah,
I think he's late. He think he's late.
Oh, man, this was a great show. Ms. Johnson, we'll give everybody your social media sites and everything so they can get in touch with you, contact, and get some of your work.
Well, I'm on Facebook as Melanie Johnson. I also have a page named after my first book, Womanly Wisdom, and it's geared toward my authorship. I'm on Instagram as MJ2017. That's E-M-J-A-E 2017. But you can find me on LinkedIn under Melanie Johnson. I mean, not LinkedIn, but Linktree. I'm on LinkedIn as well. But Linktree has all my my contacts. So just look up Melanie Johnson. You'll find me.
And where can people find your work?
Oh, I'm sorry. My work is on Amazon. The books that I have authored, as well as the ones that I am collaborating with, are all available on Amazon. It's funny that this came up because I just unpublished my first book on Amazon, and I'm republishing it with a global ISBN, so it can be sold in stores. And once that happens, I'll update everybody and let them know. So I just hit the publish button tonight.
Yes. Man, what a great show tonight. We have run out of time. Any last?
We're going a whole different direction.
That's good. We had a chapter moment. You know how you get in them dark moments. You always got to come out of them.
Yeah.
Like if you was in church, that would have been like. So if that was church, that would have been the moments where everybody was like, was feeling the same Holy Ghost or whatever. You know, maybe you could answer that for me if you wanted.
Yeah.
Is that what we just did?
Yes. I really enjoyed tonight. It was fun. I enjoyed
We had a praise party.
I enjoyed meeting you guys.
A praise party. Yeah. She'd be teaching me about church, and I'll be giving her the real word. I won't go off.
No.
She'd tell me the Bible stories, and I'd tell her what I really think happened.
I got you. And it's never... No. Moving right along.
That's a whole other show.
Yes, indeed.
That's a whole other month.
Oh, Lord.
So, Ms. Johnson, I'd love to share with y'all sometimes.
Words you want to say to the people out there?
I just want to say to everybody that might be out there listening to stop being silent. You never know when your voice may be the voice that can help somebody, can be that cry that's out there in the wilderness. So if something is going on and you can speak to somebody and give them some information to help them, whether it's a word of encouragement or telling them where they can go and get some help or assistance, do that. Don't sit back and watch things happen. Do something about it.
Definitely. And I want to thank you so much for coming on this show tonight. Wow, you really have a truly inspirational story. Your poetry is on point.
Absolutely.
Thank you. And I've enjoyed being here tonight. I thank you all.
Yes.
Absolutely.
We have a little weird
we always talk about how we're like the special ed network. Like all of us, like we don't live in the same city, but like I think all the hosts that work for this network were short yellow bus students, including me. So we're the wacky gang or whatever, you know. Like I told you in the pre-interview before I brought you in, we like to be like family, relax, and have fun. And that's what we is here, a big family.
Awesome. Felt right at home.
Great.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we thank you for tuning in to the Gift of Might Network and joining another week of the Author's Lounge with your host, Ezzy, in the building.
Yes, sir.
Next week, we promise we will bring God of Love back. We had to tie her up this week. That's how they punish. I just got out of my cage. That's how we punish each other. around here or whatever, so we had to put her up. But no, we definitely shout out to God is Love, and she will be back next week. Yeah, I hope I did a good job. I hope I did everybody justice. My name is Aziz, the pulmonologist.
All right.
Peace. All right.
And hair grease. Peace, love, and hair grease.
Peace, love, and hair grease.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.